Hello and welcome to SwissInfo's Morally Complex podcast for November the 28th. I'm Susan Masika.
Es lebe die nationalsozialistische Bewegung! Es lebe Deutschland!
German cities were a dangerous place for anyone during the Second World War. Germany's Jews, however, faced additional existential threats after the Nazis came to power in 1933. David Torin grew up in Breslau. Now it's a part of Poland, but at the time it was the fifth largest city in Germany. When Torin was born in 1925, Breslau had a flourishing Jewish population of about 23,000. By the end of the war, there were only 160 Jews left. Most, like Torin, left everything behind and escaped, but thousands died in concentration camps. Torin had a favorite painting that he never expected to see again. It was Two Riders on the Beach by Max Liebermann, which the Nazis had taken from his great-uncle. But in November 2013, headlines announced that more than 1,000 masterpieces had been found in a Munich apartment. Torin's lawyer spotted the painting on TV, the painting that his client had been looking for 75 years. SwissInfo's Thomas Stevens speaks to the author of a new book on the Munich collection, which was bequeathed to a Swiss museum. Stay tuned to find out whether David Torin ever got his painting back.
Cornelius Gurlitt was 13 when he watched his home city of Dresden go up in flames. His world was destroyed again in February 2012 when German authorities entered his Munich flats suspecting he was a tax dodger. 18 months earlier, he had been randomly stopped on a train from Switzerland holding 9,000 euros in cash. They were stunned to find it packed with masterpieces by artists such as Picasso, Renoir and Matisse. These were confiscated, although Gurlitt had committed no crime, and the lawyers and art historians got to work. Global interest in the collection grew even more when it turned out that Gurlitt's father, Hildebrand, had been one of four art dealers licensed to buy and sell artworks on behalf of Hitler. Now, a year after Cornelius' death, Berlin-based journalist Catherine Hickley has written a book on the Gurlitt collection called The Munich Art Hoard, Hitler's Dealer and His Secret Legacy. In it, readers are taken from the anti-Semitism of pre-war Germany, where many desperate Jews were forced to sell their possessions at ridiculously low prices, to the dilemma of the Bern Fine Arts Museum, which last November said it would accept the collection surprisingly left to it by Cornelius Gurlitt. Along the way, Hickley looks at the problems of provenance and at what she calls the dreadfully slow and obstructive restitution process for claimants like David Torin. Although all the headlines were about Cornelius Gurlitt, the book focuses on his father. I caught up with Catherine Hickley, who occasionally contributes articles to SwissInfo.ch, in a studio in Berlin where she was in the middle of her book tour. I asked her what it was about Hildebrand Gurlitt that she found so fascinating.
Hildebrand Gurlitt was the ambivalent, paradoxical one who really interested me. How could this man, who was an anti-Nazi, basically, he was fired from one job because he had the flag sawn off the front of his gallery because he didn't want to have to hang the swastika. So he was an anti-Nazi, maybe even a communist. He was a quarter Jewish. He loved this art that the Nazis hated. How could someone like that end up working for Hitler and end up buying art for the Führer Museum in Linz? It was a mystery to me, those paradoxes. But what I found out, really, was that it was a combination of greed and ambition and the desire for status that led him to make some compromises with his integrity, to make some fairly terrible compromises, actually. I mean, there's no question that he bought art very cheaply from Jews who were trying to leave the country and then sold it on at a profit. And there's also no question that he bought art that he knew had been stolen from Jews. So what that kind of showed to me in a way was that when you're operating in a criminal regime, when you're working under those situations in a totalitarian government, the only way to advance is by making some pretty severe compromises ethically. And to do the right thing, to be moral, you would have to prioritize that above everything else. And that, in many cases, would actually mean risking your life. And most people didn't do that, as we know. So to me, Hildebrandt Gurlitt is one of many, many, many Germans who made those kind of compromises rather than stick his neck out and take a risk by opposing the regime publicly. But I don't think he was either one of the great, great evildoers. I think he was really someone who allowed himself, his moral compass, to completely go astray just because he was trying to make progress and advance in an evil regime.
And actually, after the war, his Jewish grandmother almost became a help in that when he was being interrogated by the Allies, he could say, well, look, I'm quarter Jewish.
Exactly. You know, he could convince people by that he was endangered, that he was operating as someone who felt like a victim of the Nazis. And that was a very interesting thing generally after the war, that suddenly there were lots and lots and lots of victims of the Nazis and not that many perpetrators. And I think the thing that I worked out while doing the research for this is that being a victim doesn't necessarily mean you're not also a perpetrator. You can be both. And it's very sort of grey area, very complex, but it was these moral issues that interested me.
After the war, he didn't exactly go out of his way to help Jews who were looking for their paintings. I mean, that would have been a good chance to make amends, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and this is the thing that I think is most unforgivable about his career, that when Jews who had sold artworks to him came to find him after the war and ask him where their artworks were and what he'd done with them, he refused to give information. He often got lawyers to answer their letters and said he didn't remember what had happened to them and that all his business books had been burned in the war. And yet some of the sales, I really do not believe that he wouldn't have remembered. I'm sure that he would have done. So, yes, I mean, that at a time when he could have given information and helped the Jews without fear of reprisals, he didn't do it. And that seems pretty unforgivable.
What lessons have been learnt from the Gurlitt collection?
Well, at the moment, I'm questioning really how far the lessons have been learned. When I wrote the book, I was a lot more optimistic. But in the last 6 months, there are a lot of things that I was hoping would have happened by now, and they haven't. One of them is that only two of the pictures in the Gurlitt collection have been returned, which is a bit of a lame record, really. There are two more that we know are looted art, and they still haven't been returned. And the whole bureaucracy involved in actually conducting the restitutions has been just dreadfully slow and dreadfully obstructive. So for the claimants, they've all got incredibly frustrated by that.
What's the main problem, though? Is it the German legal system?
Yes, it is, but also it's how you interpret the law and how strictly and stringently you want to go by the book. So a lot of it is also the bureaucracy, the German government officials who are in charge of doing this, not wanting to put a foot wrong or make a mistake and covering themselves the whole way. You know, of course, they would argue, well, what if we hand it back and then we find out it was the wrong thing to do for some reason, you know. But there's caution and there's also empathy. And, you know, in this situation, one would hope that empathy would outweigh bureaucratic concerns. Another thing that hasn't happened, and I was hoping and thinking would happen, is a change in the law, which would ease the statutes of limitation so that claimants would actually have a chance of succeeding in getting Nazi-looted art back in law. That hasn't happened, and as far as I know, it really doesn't look as though it will. There were proposals put forward in the spring this year by Bavaria, and there was some pressure from the Greens and other parties to make a change to the law. And everyone agreed it would be a good idea to do that, but it's just fallen by the wayside.
Why is that?
Well, lots of things. I mean, the main reason is because it's an incredibly complicated thing to do constitutionally, because it would have to be a retroactive law, and that's against the Constitution. So one would need to find a formula to get around that. A lot of lawyers in the past have said that it's actually impossible to do this. But I would think that where there is a will, there is a way. And if your law does not reflect public policy and thinking on this issue, then you have a duty to change the law. And that still hasn't happened. And of course, Germany has had a lot of other things on its plate, like the refugee crisis and so on. But I still hope that someone's going to look at it again and come up with some kind of a solution.
The You also said it's surprisingly easy to sell Nazi-looted art without being detected. Is that still the case?
It is still the case, but it's got much, much harder. And that is something we have the internet to thank for, really, because it's so much easier to search on databases online. And there are also more organisations who carry out that work for people. And I think buyers are just becoming much more aware of the risks of provenance when they're buying art. So there is much more caution. But of course, there's a whole new problem now in the... Well, I mean, it's not a new problem. It's been a problem that's been around for many years, but one that has got much worse in the last few years with antiquities stolen from war zones in Syria and Afghanistan and so on and Iraq. And that these antiquities are all flooding the art market and being sold. And, you know, we're actually losing information about our civilization as a result. So... You know, the art market still has plenty to worry about, and it is a completely unregulated market, and Nazi-looted art will still be sold, and maybe in secret private deals, and there's nothing you can really do to uncover that, to expose that. So, although it's getting much harder, it's still possible.
The last time we spoke, it was almost a year ago, just before the Bern Museum of Fine Arts accepted the Goerlitt collection, which Cornelius had left it in his will. At the time, you said you would be surprised if they turned it down, which they didn't, but they are currently involved in various legal issues and not a single painting has been put on display yet. Do you think they regret accepting the collection?
I hope not. I mean, my wish would be that the Kunstmuseum in Bern sees this as a fantastic opportunity. First of all, because it's a great collection, but secondly, to do the right thing and to show how it should be done. And that means exhibiting the art, of course, but it also means putting all the provenance details of every single artwork in that collection online. It means inviting information from other people. It means asking claimants to come forward. It actually means going in search of claimants, if possible. But if you do it right, and if you have, you know, the right resources to do it, which I think Bern does have, actually, then you could really set an example to the rest of the world and at the same time have this wonderful art collection, which definitely complements the collection in the Kunstmuseum very well. So I hope that Bern will see the opportunities rather than the risks.
Is it possible to say when some of the 1,280 works in the Munich Art Hoard will eventually go on display? I mean, this is what the public wants. They want to see some of these paintings.
At this stage, we just don't know. There's been lots of ideas circulating, but it's all rumours until the court in Munich has reached its decision. And it looks as though there might be a decision on the will of Cornelis Goerlitt in the springtime in February. But we'll see. It could easily get delayed for any number of reasons. But if that does go through, then I hope very much that there will be an exhibition soon afterwards. And, you know, it's obviously something that has to be thought about extremely carefully and done with extreme tact and diplomacy and involving potential claimants. And certainly those pieces which have already been identified as looted, we need to know the full story, and that needs to be a part of any exhibition.
That was Catherine Hickley, author of The Munich Art Hoard, talking to Swiss Info's Thomas Stevens. So was David Torin ever reunited with two riders on the beach? Yes, it was sent to him in New York in May. He and his family decided to sell it, and the following month it was auctioned off for 2.8 million francs, more than three times the pre-sale upper estimate. Read more about this story and other Swiss news and views at swissinfo.ch. Thank you for listening, and thank you to studio technician Donnie Wheeler. This program was produced by Thomas Stevens. I'm Susan Masika.